when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Welcome to Democracy Sausage for this week. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University. I'm also with the School of Politics and International Relations. And this podcast comes out each week, as I said, from the ANU. And look, a week after the federal budget, and it's clear where the government's priorities are, and I guess where the opposition's priorities are, or at least where they aren't, we've seen where the opposition intends to go, we think, because there's been a fair amount of support for the budget, some criticism about its inflationary impact that the opposition says it has, and some other matters, and we'll get into that. But I think as an opening observation, I'd say that the budget was quite a surprising budget in the sense that it eventually named a surplus, and we've seen some criticism of the budget along the lines I just mentioned from the opposition, but there's been no real holding of it, below the waterline. Instead, we see the opposition's probably inclined to support most of the spending measures in the budget. So we'll see how that all gets reconciled, both fiscally but also politically in coming days. Now, joining me to unpack these and related issues are a couple of old hands at Democracy Sausage, Dr. Liz Allen, aka Dr. Demography, if you are on Twitter, who is Senior Lecturer in the College of Arts and Social Sciences. Welcome back, Liz.
It's good to be back.
And Associate Professor Ben Phillips from the Centre for Social Research and Methods, who's done some, obviously because he's very much in this sort of economic sphere, done some interesting work on this recently. And I think, Ben, again, welcome back to you. It's been quite a while since we spoke to you, but welcome back.
Good afternoon, everybody.
And you hosted you were part of a post-budget breakfast the other morning at the Museum of Australian Democracy, one of the best buildings in Canberra, let's be honest, the old Parliament House, and you went through some of these figures. I guess might be a good place to start, really. What was your overall impression of the budget?
So, look, I'm a little bit conflicted, and I think part of it is that over the past sort of 14 or 15 years, I've modelled the last 15 budgets. This can be a bit of a soul-crushing thing to do in that one often has these big expectations of all these amazing measures that you might implement or you could implement or all the great things government can do. And the reality is that each budget actually doesn't tend to do a huge amount. So,
and that's the case both fiscally or economically but also politically as well. I mean, there's sort of a lot of heat around budgets, but in some ways they're not as interesting as those of us in the beltway, as they say in the US, might imagine.
I think that's right. I think there was a hope, an expectation, and I didn't really share that myself, that say there'd be a very large increase to welfare payments, in particular the job seeker payments. So I'm a committee member of the Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee, and they'd recommended a pretty substantial increase to job seeker of about $260 a fortnight.
So this would have taken it to, and the formula was to 90% of the single age pension.
That's right. So currently you were on about $690 a fortnight. It would have increased their payments to about $950 per fortnight. So a huge increase that would be. And there's people who had, I guess, some expectations that might happen or it should happen. And the reality was only a $40 per fortnight increase. So from about 6:90 to about 7:30. So that sounds disappointing, and perhaps it really is disappointing. $40 out of $260, you can all do the maths on that. It's a pretty small fraction. Mm. But also, having done 15 budgets in a row, I'm used to seeing budgets being cut for welfare. This is probably the first budget where that's actually turned the corner and there's been a very, very small increase. So depends which way you want to look at it. But in terms of welfare, it wasn't as much as it needs to be increased, but I guess it's a start, is how I probably felt about the budget.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, everyone, Liz, could see that, you know, $40 a fortnight, $20 a week, or what did that work out to? $2.78 a day or something, I think was the number, which is not going to even get you a cup of coffee.
Doesn't get you a loaf of bread.
No. We all remember Amanda Vanstone's famous, you know, you wouldn't fund a milkshake and a hamburger or whatever, sandwich, I think it was. This wouldn't get you one of those items by itself. So in that sense, it might have felt kind of almost tokenistic or piecemeal, but it is important. I mean, Ben's point is important, right? We have not had governments expanding welfare payments at all in recent times. And I've asked personally, as listeners of this podcast would know, I've asked personally treasurers for a number of years now, often at the budget, the day after the budget, the press club address that treasurers traditionally do, asked them and shadow treasurers what they were going to do about unemployment benefit. And the formula for both sides has always been the same. We don't have any plans to increase unemployment benefit. That, you know, the argument, the sort of argument that wasn't stated that you hear from advisors and so forth was there's no votes in the unemployed. Yes, there's been a small change here, but there's been in some ways a significant change in mindset. We've actually had a government make an increase.
Definitely the recognition. I think it is disappointing that it wasn't more, but I think that's because people, particular elements of the community, hold a progressive government or the Labor government to a different standard to a conservative government. And I think as a result of that, there were expectations and there were hopes that a Labor government would come in and make drastic reform, which of course for its own survival can't, right? Mm. So it's not in our government's interest to make massive reform, because it's not going to sustain them or in any way be strategic for their longevity. So I guess what we've seen is a recognition that people on welfare are human and they deserve to be recognised and their humanity recognised, but at the same time, obviously can't do much. And I think that recognition is great, but at the same time it's quite sobering, I think, and painful for a lot of people.
Yeah, and part of that, as you say, is about expectations, not just expectations of a Labor government, which I think is right. I think that's absolutely true, and there was a sort of a sense that this government was going to after a, you know, long period, nearly a decade of the other side, that this government was going to sort of solve a number of problems, some of which were getting worse through that period, this, you know, like the sort of the cost of living gap between what you were getting on JobKeeper and the actual cost, you know, was getting worse and worse. So, yes, there are expectations that are around government, but there are also expectations around that particular thing. And in the context of the budget, we know there was a very very strong and public and persuasive case made by a number of people, including the committee Ben was on, to lift the dole, to do something sort of structural and serious here. Mm. And in the end, I guess it doesn't feel like it was structural and serious. I mean, serious in the sense that we've just covered, but not dramatic in terms of reshaping the lives of people who are on that unemployment benefit.
And you're right. It's not going to do anything substantive for people who are on these payments, right? That's just the reality. I mean, and that amount per day is not going to get you a loaf of bread at Coles or Woolies, right? It's just not. So it feels like a bit like shush money, you know. It's not enough to really make a difference for people who are on welfare, but it's just enough to say exactly what we've been saying, which is, well, at least they did something. It's the first time that they've done something in a long time. So it's politically very strategic and smart from the government's perspective. But, yeah, I do really consider what our priorities are. And I think, you know, we keep hearing politicians say, you know, budgets at a national level are much like a budget at the household level. It's all about priorities. And we can tell a lot about the priorities of a government and perhaps a nation based on policies and the budget. And I don't know, I'm worried about where our priorities lie.
Yeah, although, as I say, I think we have to acknowledge that there were some better signals in terms of where priorities lie and the fair treatment of all citizens, including, as the Treasurer made the point at that post-budget address about helping the most vulnerable. He said, this is the basis of, that is people who can afford to help out through the tax and transfer system, helping those people who are most vulnerable. That is the basis of social welfare, social security, and it was ever thus. And we've got a recognition of that. There's at least a coming together of a kind of the underweening logic of political discourse and the realities for people on the ground. Ben, I wonder if, going back to your committee and the recommendation about putting it to hiking it up to 90% of the aged pension. I wonder if, and thinking about this in terms of the idea of structural reform, whether this could only ever be seen, what we've just seen in this budget, could only ever be seen as kind of piecemeal, even though notwithstanding the amount's small anyway, but because it's not indexed in the way the pension is.
Yeah, I think one thing we probably should mention is that there was one area where there was a significant reform, and that was for single parents.
Yes, I was going to come to that.
So I think that the $40 per fortnight is in one way, to be honest, it's a bit pathetic really. But certainly for the single parents, we had a very substantial increase where those with older children, once your child turns eight under the current system, you're shifted on to the job seeker payment, and that's going to now you'll be staying on the parenting payment until your youngest child is 14. So that's a pretty dramatic change for those persons. They'll get about $100 per week or $200 per fortnight as an increase in their payment. So that's easily enough to buy a loaf of bread and to do all sorts of things that Liz is concerned that won't be able to be happening for those who are left behind. It's only a small number of people, though. I think it's budgeted or projected to be about 60,000 people. So not a big change. You've still got another 900,000 people on the job seeker payment and related payments who are really languishing on a very, very low payment. And as you mentioned, there's the other structural issues around, say, the indexation of the payments into the future. So the situation only gets worse into the future without some other more substantial increases. Now, having said that, I think with the Economic Inclusion Committee, I think there'll be continued pressure on the government each budget update even, to do more work in this area, so to increase those payments or to look at other areas such as the more structural elements such as the indexation of the payments and perhaps look at some of the other payments as well. It's not just the job seeker that's struggling. We had an increase to rent assistance, which was welcome. That was, I think, a 15% increase to the payment.
And the government makes the point, and it's a valid point, that a lot of people who are on unemployment benefit are going to be eligible for rent assistance, and they're going to benefit from some of the Medicare changes and some other things. So there's a suite of things that hopefully will help to take some of the pressure off for people living right on the margin.
I think that's certainly true, but I'd still certainly argue that those people who are just on, say, the base payment of the job seeker payment, they're basically getting $40 a fortnight extra. They might get about $15 or $20 extra per fortnight with, say, rent assistance. That's still not really nearly enough. There's still a very long way from the poverty line there. I think even with this increase, they're still about $300 or so dollars per fortnight lower than the poverty line. So it's still a pretty marginal existence if that's a payment you're on for a long time. If you're on the payment for a short time, only say a 5 or 6 weeks, and you had some other resources, it probably isn't a big deal and maybe it's okay. But increasingly, you've got an issue with the job seeker payment, a structural issue that you've got lots of people who are on that payment who perhaps 20 years ago wouldn't have been on that payment. They would have been on, say, disability support payment or the single parent pension or some other payment. So that's another issue. It's not just a matter of the payment being too low, but the people who are on that payment are no longer just those who are ideally just transitioning between one job to the next. If that was the case, they're on the payment, say, for a month or two, it's probably not such a big deal. But increasingly you've got people who are on that payment for months, years, perhaps even decades for some people. So for those people, it's a big problem to be on that payment that's so low for so long. Even though there's been a small increase, it's not really enough.
That's right. And some of those people who are on that payment, on that unemployment payment, are in that older age bracket. We've seen a change there as well, haven't we? Reducing from, I think, 60 to 55, the point at which extra assistance cuts in, a higher rate of the dole.
Yeah, so on the current system, once you turn 60, your payment, instead of being, say, $693 a fortnight, it's about $750 a fortnight, I think it is roughly.
And this is in recognition that you are in a cohort that is far less likely to be able to get re-employed.
That's true. I think the evidence is a little mixed on that one and not particularly strong. I think there's a lot of issues for a lot of people on that payment in terms of getting off welfare and getting into the labour market in a long-term sort of a way. So they've shifted it from being age 60 to age 55, where you now benefit a little bit from a slightly higher payment. And it is true that some older people, some older women in particular, might have a few more battles in terms of getting a job. But you've also got a very large cohort within that group who are deemed to be called the partial capacity group. And these are people, it's about 40% of those on the payment in total, I think. And these are people who have a very limited ability to work, say, at a full-time amount. So those people are also likely to struggle to get employment. So they're likely to languish on that payment potentially for many, many months, many, many years, which is, I think, is very concerning.
Mm. Liz, a lot of those people, as Ben just said, and this was a function or a feature of the discourse leading up to the budget as well, are older women.
Yeah.
And there's some argument about whether this group is as, you know, is the fastest growing group or whatever it was. You know, I've seen a fair bit of to and fro on social media and in some of the commentary around this. But certainly for women who have been victims of domestic violence, yep, who've been come out of separations and divorces with very, very limited resources. You know, we know that women's super is super savings are generally lower than men's and so forth. And these are people in many cases whose ability to re-enter the workforce, his attractiveness to the workforce, is not that great, and who may not have the mobility. This is one of the other things that doesn't get talked about a lot. But it's all very well to say there's a number of vacancies in you know, employers can't fill some of these vacancies, but not everyone on the unemployment benefit is able to take up those vacancies or is attractive to those employers.
Mm. Certainly leading up to the budget, there was a leak or was it, what did we decide it was? It wasn't a leak, perhaps a strategic release of information.
That's generally a drop.
That kind of suggested that people 55 and over would be the only beneficiaries of an increase. And that alone got me very worried. I think that I'm not discounting anything that we've just discussed around the disadvantage or the vulnerability that people over the age of 55 experience. It concerned me from, I guess, a demographic perspective that there was this kind of potential for a wedge. We've already got enormous intergenerational kind of issues going on, particularly around the transference of wealth, around home ownership, rates of home ownership, generation to generation, mental health, suicide, rates of self-harm, all of these things, you know, are particularly concentrated among younger people. And, you know, the demographic theories are that if we look after people early on in life, then we have the greatest potential to correct inequalities or make impact with regard to the adverse consequences, redressing the adverse consequences of inequality, if we can tackle it early on. So that kind of idea that we would do it at one end and not across the board or not at all for people under 55 was greatly concerning to me. So I'm glad that we've seen both a recognition of the particular sensitivities and issues for people over 55 while also recognising that we needed help across the board. But I just still have this really significant niggling feeling of this kind of this festering intergenerational warfare that I think we, you know, if you look on social media, Twitter in particular at the moment, I kind of accidentally unleashed a bit of a storm concerning trying to debunk a myth around whether older women were the fastest growing group among homeless Australians. And it just, you know, it exploded beyond belief. I just thought I was just kind of presenting facts.
Things are normally so calm on Twitter. I don't know.
What happened? I don't know, my naive mind, I'm thinking, these are facts. People are going to be into facts, right?
People aren't
keen on facts, right?
If they don't support their original proposition.
Exactly. Yeah. Not if it kind of went against their ideological frame of the world. And I think what made me realize even more in that moment was we've got a massive problem with kind of fake news and alternative facts across the ideology spectrum in Australia.
And we've got a problem with envy mongers as well, people who are sort of constantly trying to find out, well, who doesn't benefit from this and how do I step forward and represent them? And we've seen a fair bit of that. Someone said to me prior to the budget, oh, well, there'll be some grief if, you know, from middle Australia if the unemployment benefit gets adjusted. And I thought, oh, come on, no one's going to worry about that. I mean, no one could seriously argue that that is sustainable. Every economist, we've got employers. I mean, the vast array of people who were saying that the unemployment benefit was so low that it was itself a barrier to re-entry to work and needed adjusting. Mm. And then you get people saying that, well, I've been somewhat disagreeably surprised in the days afterwards that there are those people, and some of them are in the opposition, who are arguing that the budget does nothing for middle Australia. Mm. And that, you know, increasing the dole, which the opposition has not committed to yet, even parsimonious though that amount is, the opposition is not committed to it. So there's a fair amount of envy farming going on, I think, in our politics. I'll just we'll come back to that because we need to go to a break, and we'll be back with this discussion in just a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm with Ben Phillips and Liz Allen, and we're discussing the budget and a whole lot of issues that come around that. We were just talking about the sort of social politics of this budget. What's your response to what I was just saying, Liz, before the break about, you know, just the extent to which, you know, some people have been out there kind of really, leveraging this idea that the budget has disadvantaged middle Australia?
As people, we tend to lack perspective. So we view the world through our own challenges and our own issues, and without regard for what it might be like for others. So our perspective on the world, say, for example, if we are a middle income family, might be that we're struggling, right? But the struggle of someone, this middle income family, is very different to what the struggle looks like for someone on a low income or on welfare. And the same applies to someone at the top end of town. Our perspective, we don't seem to realise that our own experiences cannot be used to determine anybody else's worth or right to something.
It's a good point, but Ben, it's also true to say that probably those households that Liz was just talking about, let's call them kind of middle-income households, that might be really feeling the pinch from high interest rates and inflation and energy costs and so forth, that to them it may feel as real. You know, if they are seriously having to contemplate the idea of not being able to meet their mortgage costs because they've gone up by $1,000 a month or more, yes, it may be that objectively we can look at that circumstance and say, well, you've got the capacity to cut some costs, you know, get rid of the second car or even move to cheaper housing. But they are pretty substantial steps backwards. And we shouldn't really be surprised, I suppose, that some people are going to be saying, well, I'm really feeling the pinch here. I'm in middle Australia and I didn't get anything out of the government.
Sure. Look, I think I'd be in agreement with Liz that, I mean, my main concern as a social researcher tends to be those who are really struggling, which is those at the bottom end, the low income earners and the welfare recipients who are, say, on the job seeker payment. Having said that, looking at the numbers, I can certainly see that the last 12 months has been challenging for some in the middle and even those a bit higher up. Many people have got some pretty big mortgages, and obviously interest rates have increased really quite substantially, say maybe 50% their mortgage may have increased over the past 12 months. So that's whilst you're still probably, I guess, not necessarily as financially stressed as those at the bottom, there's been a big change in your financial circumstance for some of those people, which can be confronting for some. What I would add, though, is that there's been a lot of talk about, or some talk, I'm a little more optimistic than perhaps some, but there's been quite a bit of talk about those at the bottom end getting something out of this budget and those in the middle or those at the top getting nothing at all. I would add that there are some measures coming in next financial year and the financial year after that are actually very substantial and much more substantial than what those at the bottom are getting. So you've got the childcare payments that are coming in just a couple of months' time, and that money mostly goes to middle-income Australia and to some extent higher-income Australia.
Correct.
And also, of course, you've got these big stage three tax cuts that come in about 14 months' time, and that's very much substantial, and that's very much biased towards mostly high-income families. So when you put all of this together, which I'm doing at the moment, we're about to release a research paper about that, you do see that when you just look at this budget, it certainly helps low-income families more than middle or high-income. In fact, almost exclusively low income. When you bring it all together, you look at childcare, you look at particularly the stage three tax cuts, and you also look at the welfare payments, it really skews mostly towards, in terms of dollars, very much the high income families and middle income families and not really the bottom end so much at all. So there's a longer term story there compared to the short term story.
On the politics of the budget and looking at those numbers, obviously it was a big thing for a Labor government to deliver a surplus, for any government, frankly. I mean, we hear a lot about surpluses. We don't see them so often, and we certainly haven't seen them so often recently. And a Labor government has now done it. Many people have made the point that this is politically quite significant, you know, removing a kind of or dismantling an argument that the coalition puts around that they are the superior economic managers at all times. That may be true, but of course, it's a one-off, at least on the budget numbers as we understand them at the moment. They're predicated on commodity prices coming off. But we know that the budget is also inflated by personal taxes to a higher degree than normal. Income tax, I think, has become more than half of the windfall to the government as a result of low unemployment. And we know employment is going to fall. That is, unemployment is going to rise. That's what the Reserve Bank is actually dialing into the economy at the moment, unemployment. It's another way of putting, you know, slowing down the economy. So I wonder, going back to the dole payment, for example, whether it just wasn't an option to go further because that amount is going to increase as a liability to the government as unemployment goes up.
So I think, I mean, the main concern with inflation, I guess, is the here and now. The budget paper suggests that inflation will come down in future years. Now, that's a projection or even just a hope, as opposed to we know that it's going to, of course. Look, in my view, the increase in the welfare payments is relatively minor, and even if they had gone the whole hog and gone the full $260 per fortnight that the that EAC, or the Economic Inclusion Advisory Committee, recommended in a sense, I don't think that would have been all that inflationary. You're talking about maybe $5 billion a year of extra payments. And that sounds like a lot of money. People, I think, get a bit confused about millions and billions, and it all just sounds like an enormous number. But you've also got to think that the government's its total spending each year is somewhere in the order of $600 or $700 billion per year. Consumption across the whole economy is in the order of $1,200, $1,300 billion per year. So an extra $5 billion, look, it doesn't help reduce inflation, but probably isn't going to make a very big difference either.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because advocates of stimulus payments, when times are bad and the economy needs to be protected from, you know, what they call economic headwinds internationally and so forth, we often hear the argument put by advocates of the less well off. That the payments should go to them because all of that money will be churned straight into the economy and that will be stimulatory. So is there a mismatch between those two arguments?
Look, I think so, but the stimulus payments, I think they were absolutely substantial. I mean, they were, you know, I can't remember the exact figure, but we're talking about somewhere close to $100 billion a year or more than that it might have been. I forget the exact figure.
Well,
we
were talking about COVID, you mean?
Yeah, through COVID.
$303 billion, I think.
Extraordinary amounts. So I just don't think there's really any comparison with the sort of money that was going into, potentially going into additional welfare payments. Now, one thing I'll point out, maybe this is a bit of a prickly topic, and look, I think the additional income, or not income support, but wages that's going to, say, aged care workers, wonderful thing to do, of course, but we don't worry about the inflation side of that for some reason. Whereas, say, for the unemployed people, for some reason, that's a big concern. And they're kind of fairly similar sorts of numbers of where they potentially could have gone. I think the injection into aged care, and I don't want to say that's a bad thing for a moment.
No. I wouldn't. No, I understand what you're saying.
A thing.
Yeah.
But I think it was about $11 or $12 billion over the forward estimates, which is a lot more than what was going into, say, the unemployment payment. And no one's talked about that being inflationary. And I don't think it will be. But it's interesting how these things kind of play out.
Interesting,
and it plays
Liz,
out.
Isn't it?
It's totally about priorities, right? Mm. And it comes down to, I don't know, in my head, whenever I make decisions in life, I think, well, what is it that I want to be? What is it that I want to get out of this? What's the intended outcome? And what's that going to likely impact my life or the people's lives around me, right? Why are we not thinking about what we want to be as a country?
Yeah.
What are our priorities? What is our mission statement, if you like? And I don't want to be the poo-poo on your parade, but I feel like our priorities aren't there. They're not aligning with what a lot of people would think Australia stands for, and that is that everyone gets a fair go, right? The reality is that you don't get a fair go if you're a particular type of person. Mm. And I just want to go back to this idea that, you know, around that we fail to kind of account for what other people's lives might be like. We lack perspective because we see it through our own lenses, right? Our own life experience, our own lived experiences.
But just to interrupt you there for a sec, not all of us though. I mean, there are many people who have been advocating for these improvements for people who are dependent on Social Security, for example, who do understand that or are trying to understand.
Yes, definitely. Without the advocacy for particular women's groups, I don't think we would see the great reform that we saw in the last budget. But I just want to say that in terms of this, perception is more powerful than reality. So in the main, what we perceive the world to be, take crime rates, for example, research shows that if we think something is true, then we behave like it is true, right? Regardless of whether or not someone wants to fact check us and tell it's wrong.
Hmm.
Even when we've been corrected, we still go on gut. And I think we need a bit of a reality check in Australia, and it would be nice to have more voices from advocacy groups being elevated so that we could hear these perspectives and so that we could get more of a reality check. I'm not sure whether it would be terribly successful. It might anger particular aspects of the voting Australian public, but I just have this feeling that we are headed in a direction that it feels like we're somewhat out of control. We've lost our way. We need to pause for a minute and just take a breath and have a reality check.
Well, yes, I understand what you're saying, and I think it's a very persuasive point. Aren't there some reasons also for some optimism about that in the sense that we have seen a change of government and a yes. government that has, albeit in these very incremental ways, but yes. nonetheless stepped into this debate?
Yes.
I thought Chalmers's defence of Social Security the other day was very forceful. There is a lot more work to be done here, and there are political constituencies that need to be built for social change,
yes.
for social, political, economic change. You can't just come in and pull a bunch of levers
and
hope that it all works. I mean, you made that point in your opening remarks about what's politically achievable. Governments
That's
need
right.
to survive. You can't improve the country from opposition.
But I think you've hit the nail on the head. You can run an information campaign or say something that signals a leadership or signals priority while also taking different action. So that sounds like propaganda, but let me explain that. So say, for example, you can say budget's really bad, right? And think about it again. I say that to my kids. Look, times are tough at the moment. We can't afford that right now. And then I will have this conversation about the importance of these things or the value of whatever, right? In terms of what mummy thinks about these things. And I think we need to see a little bit more of this from this government. Okay, times are tough, we're doing what we can, but we actually hold these values. And I think they are doing it. But I'm not sure that it's getting the traction or the messaging is right yet.
So that's about political leadership.
Yes.
And it's about political authority or
yes.
having the political capital to sort of do that and to spend and to sort of weigh into some of those arguments. I mean, the big kind of stone on the heart of all of this really, and you mentioned it before, Ben, is those stage three tax cuts. A formula that a Labor government would not have designed itself, a formula that came about because Labor in opposition did not want to give the then Liberal government the leverage to say a new Labor government would be coming after your wealth, would be taxing you more. We propose these tax cuts, they're going to roll them back, that kind of thing. And Labor did try and separate out the tax package that the Morrison government put forward, but was rebuffed on that. The government did what governments do. It said, no, this is a tax package. You have to vote for the whole thing. And in the end, Labor decided to support high-end tax cuts in order to get earlier ones for people down the scale. But nonetheless, going to Liz's point, this is a big kind of conundrum, I suppose, a big contradiction for Labor, really. It's about Albanese and Chalmers are both sort of strongly committed to these tax cuts coming in, which are already legislated. As you said, they come in July of 2024. They will give $9,000 a year to people over $200,000 a year. That's a fair windfall.
Yeah, look, I mean, the stage three tax cuts, when they come in 2024, it's about $18 billion. And that, as you point out, mostly goes to the top 20% of the income distribution. And that compares to the $40 per fortnight increase is about $1 billion per year, which goes to the bottom 20%, bottom 40% mostly.
Will those cut the stage three tax cuts, will they be inflationary?
Look, it's a good question. I think
people have got so much money there, they're not going to spend it.
I think the argument there, which I have some sympathy for, I can think of arguments for and against whether they're inflationary, but it's coming in 2024 and in budget world anyway, in the budget papers, inflation's on the way down by then. Now, of course, that might all change in 6 months' time, or we might start getting nervous about inflation, the Gini being out of the bottle or whatever they say. Look, one point I would make is I'm a little more optimistic perhaps around, say, the Social Security side of things. There was this $40 per fortnight increase, a tiny amount of money, obviously, but the response hasn't been that negative, I don't think, overall.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, it feels a little different. Having been modelling these things and being in this space for probably 10 or 15, about 15 years, I think if you went back 10 or so years ago, say when Abbott had just come in 2013 or 2014, whatever it was, yeah. I think the mood was very much against those sorts of things. So yes. I think if that had been increased back then, there would have been much more of an outcry. I haven't seen a lot of opinion pieces. There's been one or two. I think there was one by maybe Peter Credlin over the weekend. But by and large, there hasn't been a lot of negativity against it. It doesn't seem like a huge negative for the government. Whereas I think if you went back 10 years or so ago, there would have been a lot more talk about bludgers. It's been a little bit this time.
I think that was the word in the headline of her very piece that you referred to, yes. Bludgers. I mean,
there hasn't been too much of it, though. There's been a few pieces here and there, but it's more been talk about, there's not really fiscal room for this at the moment, as opposed to the sort of the bludger discourse, I feel.
Mm. Yeah. Just finally, in the time we've got left, the other thing that is a big feature of the budget is the population projections. Liz, you're a demographer.
Yes.
1.5 million extra people. Peter Dutton's out there saying this is adding a population the size of Adelaide to the population over the next 5 years. I suppose we're meant to panic, should we?
Don't panic. Don't panic. You no need to panic. Let's put this in perspective, right? It's almost like the opposition really can't fault the government's budget, right? So what else are they going to go hard against the government with? Population. Population is one of those things that we see wheeled out around elections, around any kind of sticky kind of situation, because the moment we spark the population fear, it's like it takes its own course, it's out of control, and it's this populist politics that is vile, but it's strategic and it helps historically conservative governments. And so it's a strategy. And I got to say, I kind of predicted that it would happen. I suspected that that's
the numbers
exactly.
Aren't, yeah, the numbers aren't dramatically different from what would have happened under.
So,
in fact, I think the previous government's projections, had COVID not come around, was that we would already be at 27 million.
So look, if we hadn't had COVID, we would have had a bigger population. And so what we're seeing with the numbers of net overseas migration, they look very high. They are high, but that's because they're high because we had a pause during COVID. Borders were closed. We effectively had a deficit. We had more people leaving the country than coming, by tens of thousands.
So it's a catch-up effectively?
Not. I wouldn't say catch-up, because when we say catch-up, people will think in their head.
Sauce.
That's
ketchup.
We're playing catch-up, or we're trying to fill the void that we lost. We'll likely never see that population. It's gone to us, if you like. Just consider what it is, rather, is we hit pause and we've then hit the play button again, opening borders. We had so many people leave during COVID that we now don't have the levers who are exiting the population to offset those that are coming terms of the numbers.
Yeah, so that's the importance of saying net.
The net, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what will happen, though, is that any student who was perhaps ready to go in the next 2 years would have left, even though they had, a couple of years still left on their degree, for example, or workers. They did exactly what they were told, go home, even though Australia perhaps was home. So we've restarted the clock again. And now we've got higher net overseas migration than we are historically used to seeing, because we don't have the outflow that we would likely have had if we hadn't have had people leave and had this enormous deficit in NOM, net overseas migration. So don't panic. It's all down to accounting, if you like, and we're not playing catch up. So we're not like pulling more people in to kind of offset what we've been through during COVID. Not at all. We, as you said, are going to have a lower population in the medium term as a result of COVID, not a higher one because of what we're seeing now. So,
but Peter Dutton's got a point, hasn't he? Or at least there's a legitimacy to the question, where are people going to live during a rental crisis? We know that we have a housing crisis more broadly in this country, you know, the infrastructure implications and so forth. If there's an answer to that, then that's good. And if there isn't an answer to it, then I suppose it establishes a legitimate concern.
Look, and Ben could speak more about housing, definitely, but who helps build homes in Australia? Workers that come from overseas help, right? The biggest chunk at the moment of people that are coming to Australia are students. Where do they typically live? They typically live around their place of education, mm-hmm. where there is generally established
accommodation.
Yeah, exactly. So it really angers me that we have these two issues connected. You know, we hear population is an issue, increasing rates of population growth are an issue, and generally that's code for we don't like immigration. Dutton even didn't go the population is a problem issue. He went straight to immigration. He bypassed the code and went straight for the thing he knew would hit hard. And then this issue of congestion and so on. Take a deep breath and consider this. Our infrastructure investment in this country is woeful. From state and territories to national level, if it cannot be achieved in the political life cycle of a government, then it's not going to be invested in. Why? Because we don't want some other party to take credit for what we built or what we invested in, right? That short-term thinking has locked us in a really sticky situation when it comes to infrastructure investment and development. So we're running to stand still. When we've got all of these issues in the past, we keep kicking the can down the road. We have to build infrastructure. We have to fund it and the like, but don't believe what you've been told on population, particularly if it's been designed to scare you.
Look, I think on the housing front, an important thing to remember, which you mentioned before, Mark, is that where we're expected to be in terms of the population by, say, 2030 is actually lower today than what it was about 3 years ago. Is that right, Liz? Yep. I think it might be, yeah. So we've actually had very, very strong home building in over the last decade. We probably had the strongest period I think we've ever had. We had a housing boom. And I think there is some short-term issues at the moment. I don't think we should lose our minds, though, over the occasional short-term issue we have with housing. There is likely to be at the moment, there's obviously been an increase in construction costs and there is likely to be some reduction in the amount that we are building. But I think we can get a little bit overexcited about the ups and downs of the building cycle, and we're probably going into a bit of a down period. I don't think that makes an enormous difference to the overall population. You've got 11 million dwellings in Australia, and if you have one or two years where you perhaps build 20 or 30,000 less homes than you'd like, I don't think it makes an enormous difference in aggregate. Keeping in mind, there's obviously certain localised areas where there will be no doubt some issues. But we have built a lot of houses in the past. We'll continue to build housing in the future. The issues, I think, still really remain around the low-income households, particularly low-income renters, where we probably have a lack of supply. And we've always had, or at least in the last, say, decade or so, we've had issues around the lack of supply for low-income housing and a bit of a lack of public housing. That's where the issues are. We had a bit of a strange period through COVID where we had a reduction in the number of people per household. People wanted to live perhaps with fewer people in the household because of reasons around COVID or whatever was going on through COVID. And that may retrace its steps, that trend. We don't know if that's going to happen, but that if that retraces its trend, then that to some extent solves the problem, at least in the short term.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. We have so much more capacity in our existing housing mm-hmm. stock that is underutilized just because we're wealthy enough to do it historically. And it's just getting worse. You know, these sort of McMansions expanding everywhere and, you know, it's, you know, six bathrooms and all this sort of stuff you see. really? I mean, just endless vanity. It's vanity projects. That's what it is. Now, look, thank you. It's been absolutely fantastic discussion, really fascinating. A great way to sort of trawl through some of the issues out of the budget and get some brilliant perspectives. And I want to thank you for both being on Democracy Sausage again and look forward to talking to you again another time.
My pleasure.
I look forward to it.
That is the podcast for this week. You can get in touch with us at democracysausage@anu.edu.au. That's the email, democracysausage@anu.edu.au. And you can also subscribe to this podcast, which we'd certainly appreciate you doing, and perhaps even leave a review. Until next week, that's your lot for now. Ciao.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.